Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the Yacht Racing Podcast. I'm your host, Justin Chisholm, and I'm very pleased to welcome from Newport, Rhode Island, a guest that I've been trying to get on the podcast for a while, David Reed, who to American US listeners and viewers will be no stranger as the long-term editor of Sailing World magazine. Dave, how's Newport today?
It is steamy, but it's been a great week. We're kind of locked into this Bermuda high weather pattern, nice southerly flow. The weeknight racing has been excellent. You know, 15 to 20 knots every night, and fog and sun and summertime. It's great.
I really envy you living in Newport, and I know you grew up in Newport, and we'll get into a bit of that in a second. But whenever I've visited with the Volvo Ocean Race or the Ocean Race as it is now, or the Match Racing Tour, I just look at Newport and it's just such a haven for yacht racing, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't take it for granted any day. You know, I think even like a great example, you know, this year when they pushed the Bermuda race start, you know, up into the bay over this, you know, Sydney Hobart style exit off Fort Adams with, you know, Ken Reed and Jesse Fiedling doing the commentating, Cole Brown on the water and the crazy. It was just so cool to, you know, you kind of just take it all in, and I mean, I would have much better been on the water side of it, but from a spectator side, it was cool to see. I think Newport just keeps reinventing itself and doing cool events.
Yeah, it does. And funnily enough, I stumbled across that on YouTube. I was looking for something else, some technical stuff, and I said it's like live start of the Bermuda race, and I thought I'll just take a quick look, and I ended up watching like five starts and listening to Jesse and Ken just you know, they're commentating on it like it's the America's Cup, and it was right at the pin end of the line. It was just great. Yeah. Great to watch.
Yeah, I know. So the team on that one, they put a lot of work into, again, as a first timer, I know you know, Kate Wilson, who does the, you know, media for the event, to convince all the old timers to, you know, a, you know, move the race inside, but then you know, spend a little money on trying to engage, you know, people in a different way. And I think, you know, as those who've seen the start, you know, back when it was in the day off Castle Hill, just it was hard to get a vantage point to watch. And so to create this little festival was really cool. And, you know, local reggae band that everybody loves, and I no doubt they'll continue to do it and keep the start there as a proper good ocean start.
I hope so. Dave, let's talk about you just initially. I did some research, and there isn't a lot on the web about you. It really surprised me, actually, but you come from a big family. I think you're one of seven kids.
I am. Yeah. The reason there's nothing on the web is because, you know, in our business, it's not about me, you know, as in our role is we're here to share the stories of others. And yeah, so yeah, it's sort of this awkward thing of what kind of public profile do you maintain or just go out there and just keep writing about it and be part of the sport, but not the face of it. But anyway, grew up here. My father was he sailed a bit, did some 12 meter stuff back in the, you know, a long time ago, but then got busy raising seven kids and, you know, essentially as a small island, you know, the parents try to figure out what to do. So they, I think, progressively dropped every one of my siblings off the, you know, Newport Yacht Club, which is the good working man's club here, and trapped into sailing lessons. And I was pretty much the only of the seven that took to it. And keep, you know, certainly lucky to live here and be able to do what we do. And I did escape for 4 years down to Washington, D.C. to get my journalism degree at American University, but was able to keep sailing through school. And fortunately, at the time, when I graduated in, was it 93, I guess now, the magazine was actually owned by the New York Times. They had a portfolio of magazines from golf to sailing and a bunch of other things. And they had a paid internship program. And my plans to go to California were sort of sidelined for the summer, and then did the internship and never left. So I've been here working at the magazine for, I guess, now 30 something years. I've lost track, but yeah, I sort of joke with people that I've never done a resume or a job interview. So I count myself lucky to be able to do what we love to do and write about it.
Yeah. I often think about who's got the best job in sailing. And I think you must be one of the strong candidates for that, because you know, you're involved in virtually everything, and you can pick and choose what you get involved in. Is that how it feels?
Yeah. The crazy thing is we all know, you know, to wind back the clock, I'm pretty sure there was no sort of traditional internet or the internet as we know it today back when it all started. So, there was a pretty robust staff of, you know, 12, 13 people, you know, editors cramming away at the desks, and some had assistants, you know, and it was a robust staff. And then, you know, there was, it was in the early days, we used to do a fax publication called Grand Prix Sailor. And that was started with, I mean, the old legends of in our world of Ivor Wilkins and what was Marie Lesueur was a French woman. These are names that I came out of college. I had no idea who were there, but these were the legends of the yachting journalism, Rob Mundell. But they would literally file their stories and you'd kind of piece them together in a some primitive design document and sit there at the fax machine on whatever it was Tuesday and just send it out one by one by one. And it was a paid subscription service. And it was pretty wild. But, you know, that was sort of the only way to connect the international journalists into a product. But it was, you know, predated the internet and e-newsletters, right? So.
And what was the idea there? That I mean, I'd never heard of that. So the idea was that you could do stuff that was timely rather than waiting for the monthly publication.
Yeah, I'd say in a lot of sense, it was the original, you know, e-news or e-blast we call them these days. That it was, you know, traditional newspaper style things with stringers around the world, and you piece them together and out once a week, and it really sort of covered the true top end of the sport with international stringers. It was quite wild. I remember it was a lot of work back in the day, mainly just, you know, the faxing part, you know, and but there was a couple editors that were here before me, Sean McNeil, who was with the magazine for a long time. That was kind of his baby, and fully well connected. It's pretty wild, but anyway, so we've sort of gone from right pre-internet to that to you know, 12 print magazines to adding then you know, the social media to what else have we got now? Just regular, you know, web postings, and we also have what Sailing World back in 88 started what was called at the time the Nude Regatta Series, which was the National Offshore One Design Regatta Series. It was you know, it was a way to get all these 30-foot big keelboat one designs together doing a nice regatta series. And so that, boy, that in its heyday had 10 to 12 events, you know, from starting Newport to St. Pete, San Diego, LA, Toronto, San Francisco. We sort of touched all the mega centers, and we still have that today, as you know, we get the 5 events. St. Pete, Chicago, we added Detroit back this year, Marblehead and Annapolis, and then we do a Caribbean championship in October. So Sailing World as is today, I guess to make the long story short, is you know, we've got both the print that we do quarterly as a nice, beautiful way to kind of keep the storytelling going, and the great photography that we have. You know, we're absolutely fortunate to have the most insane photographers in all of sport. I mean, the Carlo Barlanghis and stuff, it just, it's always stunning no matter what. I know the people who own us say Sailing World is the most beautiful magazine in their entire portfolio. And that is 100% because of the photographers that are out there. But you know, between the print and for the website, for us, it's, you know, we're not staffed to do the news game and kind of stay on top of everything, because the sport, as we all know, is so diverse. And so for us, a real focus has been trying to deliver on what I call the how-to content or the knowledge content. It's the day-to-day stuff of how to be better at the sport that we do. And, new people, we got to understand that new people come in every day. And, you know, if you bring a trimmer onto the boat for the first time and, you know, say you're on jib tomorrow and they don't know what they're doing, the first thing is they're going to Google how to trim a jib. And if it doesn't get to Sailing World, then we've sort of missed that opportunity. So,
yeah.
Between that, the web and the social media, we got to feed it every day. Right. And, then the event. So we've got the four legs, I think, to sustain as sort of a small, you know, niche publication in this day and age.
So let's dive into that. Just describe the team that you've got there. It's much smaller now than it used to be when you started, obviously.
Yeah. Look around my office. Oh no, wait, it's only me. Yeah, I don't really. We've progressively, as you know, I think, you know, as a magazine brand, been bought and sold, I think, now 5 times since I've been here. And so it is. Yeah, I'm the core now editor in chief, and fully relying upon you know, stringers and freelancers to do the heavy lifting from abroad, and leaning on the professionals, the sailmakers and just the pros out there to get the knowledge out of them and to get them to do the from the experts writing, which is actually harder to do today. I don't think I don't know what it is, but maybe they're busier today, the pros, or they're just they don't quite see the value of passing along the knowledge. But yeah, it's harder to get the pros to do more writing than it used to be.
Interesting. Interesting.
Yeah, maybe that's a call to action for some of our friends. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I didn't realize it was literally just down to you now. And the magazine has gone to, I think I'm right in saying quarterly publication. How's that been received by the audience?
I think, the beauty of our group, you know, we're also linked with Cruising World magazine, which, you know, obviously has been around for decades as well. But, you know, they, unlike some of the other brands here in the US, like Sail Magazine or Sailing, who kind of cast a wide editorial net across sailing. And we've been true to focusing on the racing and Cruising World to the, you know, selling the dream of living in a boat and enjoying that lifestyle. And so between the two of us, it's always been a successful pattern to have really good dedicated niche audiences. And so for Sailing World, in my lifetime, you know, I think probably back in the day, it was, you know, we had as many as, you know, 70,000 subscribers. And a lot of those, as they called, they were just junk. They'd go to doctor's offices and, you know, it's just, you're just printing and wasting. And then as soon as you get to the newsstand game, then you're just printing it, absolutely wasting, because stuff just gets thrown away that doesn't get consumed. So over the time, it's been, you know, whittled down to the core 22,000. And those are 100%, you know, paid subscribers. So those are, say, yep, it's the one, you know, magazine I identify with. I enjoy it. It comes four times a year. There's definitely been an ask for more. And hopefully we'll get back to, you know, six or something like that a year. But I kind of enjoy the quarterly pace because you can just sort of slow down and really work on trying to get to the deeper stories. It allows us, you know, with small staff to try to focus on all these other bits that demand our attention from the web to social media. So I would love to get back to six, but hopefully someday. I think we were recently bought by a new company called Firecrown Media, which is based in Tennessee. And they are an absolute believer in print magazines. You know, they've learned a couple lessons along the way and they're like, holy smokes. You know, they originally went into magazine publishing thinking it was going to be a digital world. And their first foray was eye-opening to them of the demand for good quality print products. Even, you know, some of the younger staffers are in their 30s and they also were on the print is dead side, and they've been turned around as a, you know, I think people just, it's an escape for the amount of time that you want to sink in and enjoy. I love reading print magazines, you know, nightly. We have in our house, a no phone anywhere near the bed. So it's a way to go home, plug the phone in, walk away and sink your brain into something and take your time with it.
Was there ever a thought of going digital?
I think they've always thrown that, but I don't think it you know, not really. It's there. It's digital if you want it. Especially for our international subscribers, it's bundled, so you can get the print and the digital if you want. But most people just love the fact that for pretty low cost, it shows up in your mailbox and you get to enjoy it for a little while, and you can leave it on a coffee table because it's beautiful and something that just you sort of, or at least I do, you see it and you resonate with it and you identify with, that's what I love to do. And just kind of gives you that daily reminder that you love the sport.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Let's just jump back to your, you growing up in Rhode Island. You were one of seven. You were the only one that kind of latched on to sailing. What were your siblings? Where in the rankings are you? Are you oldest, middle?
Yeah, I'm third from the top. I'm not quite middle child, I guess. But it really was just sort of this product of living on a Aquinic Island / Newport that it was just as freedom, you know. And I think as seven kids, I think my parents will tell you that the goal was to get out of the house as fast as you could in the morning and just disappear on your bike and go where you want to go. And I became one of those kids that just hung around the yacht club, you know, even after my sailing lessons and, you know, doing junior instructors, or you sort of pretend to be instructors and just hanging around. That was sort of my place. And for sure, it was a different time where the yacht clubs were much more willing to just let a kid take a boat out and just disappear for the day. And so Narragansett Bay, where we raced as juniors, you know, if you wanted to go and do the race weeks up the bay in Bristol or some of these other cities, you had to sail the boat there. There were no trailers. There were no coaches to bring you there. You had to bring the boat and you would camp in a house somewhere and, you know, figure it out yourself. It's pretty wild, yeah.
It sounds really idyllic, you know. Yeah. I mean, and what was the scale of that? Like, how many boats were you racing against when you went to these regattas?
Well, these, I think they call them the Narragansett Bay Yachting Junior, you know, regattas were, you know, a lot of 420s. Not quite sure what's beeping outside the window, but hopefully that's not too distracting. The 420 regattas were always a big thing. And, you know, still can obviously here in the U.S. continue to be the dominant, you know, dinghy class for kids. So if I remember right, you know, they'd be these kind of 20, 30 boat fleets. And there were a lot of regattas in the bay, so you didn't have to travel far, and but you could get great sailing wherever you went every weekend, you know.
That's the thing that always struck me when I came to Newport was, you know, you'd walk back from the race village at the Volvo, and you'd look out across the water, and there'd be like three or four fleets of maybe 30 boats, different classes, all racing, then some dinghies thrown in, and then some guys out foiling, a bit of kiteboarding. It's just, I mean, I don't think there's anywhere else in the world that's like that, is there?
I don't know. I mean, I feel like in all my kind of travels where I go for work, I do get around quite a bit. I'm always surprised. Yeah, you kind of like, you're going to be like, oh, somewhere else is amazing. And then you come home, you're like, holy, there's so much going on here. You know, you could easily race every night of the week. You know, I think, I did some perf racing last night, and the variety of boats are still out there. You know, the battle wagons are out, and there's, you know, M32 catamarans out practicing, and winged foils and wasp guys going off the beach. And yeah, it's just like, there's just everything going on every night of the week here. It's great. And you know, some of the old classic boats, like the Shields class, which is, it's a little too slow for me, but you know, that's become the darling class for all the local pros and the industry people who are buying these 30 footers and, you know, putting out pretty well. But they have a great competitive series in the Shields fleet. The VX one, that's kind of taken off here. But other than that, there's just kind of it's not as robust one design scene as you might think in Newport. But I think when you get these other events like New York Yacht Club's two major events, the race week that happened last month and the annual that's about to happen, insane fleets and, you know, the IC37s that they have are pulling in all sorts of young people. And so the whole scene is just really robust right now.
Yeah. I've never been there for the New York race week. Does that kind of dominate the calendar in terms of the scale of it all?
It kind of kicks it off, right? It is the big one to start the summer. And obviously this year they brought in the 52s as part of their series. So that just, you know, took it up to a whole nother cool Grand Prix level. And, That to me is it's cool to kind of finally get that kind of level of racing back here. We haven't really seen. I mean, as a kid, I remember the 50 footers just being amazed by the scale and stuff. And so I feel like having the 52s back is kind of brings us back to that era a little bit. But I look at the entry list at all the New York events, you know, perf and the ORC, the one design classes. You're like, man, this is quite healthy going on here. And then the big event is always Black Island Race Week, which, you know, is every other year. And if you ever get a chance to come back here, Black Island is like heaven on earth. It is, you know, you think of Quinton Island is nice, but Black Island is just heavenly. That's a full legit 7-day race week that requires, you know, housing, and it's not a cheap week. But then you look at the entry list and you think, man, where did all these boats come from? It is just a beautiful snapshot of big boat racing with, you know, 10 to 12 people on the crew, and the sailing is really good. So I look at these events that we don't have Key West Race Week anymore, obviously, you know, and I think that they probably would have done a little bit better by going every other year like Block on the Race Week does, because these big commitment events like Block, you kind of save your time and money for, and you can't, you know, so I think those events will do well.
Yeah, I mean, the regatta scene definitely changed in the U.S.
Let me close my window here.
Yeah, that's a little
shipping truck pulling in shipments to somebody downstairs.
No worries.
New York Yacht Club, you know, when I was a kid, they weren't here. That was just the old Nicholas Brown mansion on the water. But the presence of New York and them stepping up, running way more events than they ever have here is brought the, you know, level of racing, you know, quite high here, for sure.
Yeah, the regatta scene definitely changed in the States. I remember doing some Key West race weeks and just thinking, this is incredible for a Brit to go sailing in shorts and t-shirts in January is amazing. But when we arrived, the first time we went, I almost felt like did we arrive too late? Because 3 days before the event, the bay's just full of boats practicing, and I'd never seen that before. You know, like I think it's like a 2 week commitment for some of these owners and crews to go and do that. And
yeah,
that isn't the same anymore, is it? The shorter events have kind of come to the fore now.
I think my theory has always been it's certainly been driven by the shift to smaller boats, right? And everything's on trailer. And so for us on the East Coast, you've got the migration of the 70s and the 24s and the Etchells that just pile into Miami all winter long. You can do so many events and then just work your way back north in Charleston Race Week, our Annapolis Helly Hansen Regatta. And then, you know, that's in first week in May. So then once that thing's like, you just go back to your home fleet, whether it's New England or the Great Lakes, and start your summer racing. And then the migration happens again. And so if you've got a boat on a trailer, as great as the racing is in Key West, it's pretty good in Miami too. And if you don't have to take that journey down, like Key West also got very expensive. There's no, we can't dance around that the cost of the yards and the cranes to get boats in and just to host a team for, yeah, like I said, 2 weeks, you know, a couple of weeks of practice or a week of practice, and then you're down there. It got really, really expensive. And for the, you know, the Storm Tricycle Club, which ran it on, you know, on the water, for them, it became very expensive also to house, you know, volunteers, find mark boats, just all the nits and bolts that go into running a event are very expensive. But there has been a little bit of resurgence of, you know, I think the J, what class is that? I'm drawing a blank. J111s. Started their thing with the Southernmost Regatta as a way to just get all the owners down to one of the best places to play in the winter. And it's grown into a little bit of an event, but I think the action that is in Miami, which has definitely become the, you know, the sailing epicenter of the winter here, will kind of prevent Key West from ever coming back to its glory days. You know,
okay. Plus,
people aren't racing big boats anymore. You know, it's all little stuff.
Yeah, and in its glory days, though, it was spectacular. I was racing Melges 24s and 1 year Henderson 30s, and I think we had 15 of those. I'd never even seen one before I went racing it, but like the level was so high, and the Far 40s were around then as well. I remember what we were the next start after the Far 40s, and watching the owner drivers gripping the steering wheel as they went, the pros like took them into the start line in 25 knots. I'll never forget that scene. It's just incredible.
Yeah. And I will say, you know, Key West is always amazing, but I will, you know, the first time I ever did Cows Week, I was equally blown away. You know, it's just sort of like, yeah, the water's not tropical, but the size and scale of it and the craziness and everything was like, holy smokes. You know, we think Key West is big, but that to me has always blown me away as a kind of one of the coolest events I've ever done. It was wild. You know?
While we're talking about regattas, let's just cover off the nude regattas as and tell me again what they're called now. I've forgotten, but just try and describe for us what that event, or what one of those events is all about. How's it structured?
So the nude regatta, again, National Offshore One Design, and so it was an idea to get all these kind of 30-foot classes together, racing together in a big event. And the first one here in Newport was, you know, I had these crazy sponsors of like Audi and Kahlua. It was just, it all happened down what's called the Newport Yachting Center, which doesn't exist anymore. And it was under the big tent, and it was a major. And, you know, over the years, like I said, we added events to the big sailing centers in the US, Chicago, Detroit, LA, blah, blah, blah. And so it became quite a big thing. And I personally think, because it was around so long, we sort of set the benchmark for, you know, what was now, you know, perceived to be a high quality 3 day regatta where, you know, yeah, you got to race Friday and Saturday, Sunday and big, great events every night with entertainment and food and music. And you, yeah, you'd make it, it's, as we all know, it's as much social as it is playing and on the water. So ensuring that the racing was top quality for the entire, my youth of the regatta series, we had Peter Reggio as our PRO, you know, and he was, those who know this podcast will know him of his legendary status. And
absolutely.
But the idea being that, you know, we would bring him in, it was a cost, and, you know, he probably charged us a pretty good penny. And, but that ensured that, you know, he'd show up in these quote unquote amateur race committees that run all the local racing. We're so excited to have him there, but also have him come in there and help them take their race management up to another level. They loved it. And so they just loved having him there. So just ensuring that the race management was top quality at every event was very important, as was the parties and things like that. So we've had, you know, sponsors like Mount Gay that have been there since day one, you know, 30 years into it. And then Helly Hansen is now in their 10th year. So they're obviously our title sponsor now, but preceding them, like, we had some glory years with IBM and GMC. We had some car, we got to the car manufacturers for a while. That was good. Land's End, which makes clothing, and then Sperry Topsider was with us for a long time, and it was great for them. So for Helly Hansen, I think for the backside, I've always felt like, you know, they had a pretty low awareness here in the U.S. You know, everybody knew them on the skiing side, was their DNA, but you know, the model has always been that the opportunity this yacht club brings for sponsors is particularly like New York and Chicago. Yacht clubs, rightly so, are very protective of having any commercial stuff on site, and, you know, just to be fair to members, to not, you know, put up flags and banners and stuff all over their clubhouse. And so for Helly to come in and be able to, you know, sell direct on site and be there as a presence and put their gear on the club staff, it's been really good for them. I mean, I just, and I'm not just saying because they're our sponsor, but if you go around the U.S. today, the little HH logo is everywhere you look, and it just, because it's been their long-term commitment to being there and being part of it and staying with it. But anyway, so the switch to the name, we're no longer the Nude Regatta. So our new owner never quite liked the word nude, although it was always fun when we do radio call-in shows and the local television casters would come down. We always got a good laugh out of it. And it was such an easy thing to say. Oh, you going to the Nude Regatta, or nude? We're talking nudes. And so it became the Helly Hansen Sailing World Regatta Series. And there's a little bit more to it, in the hopes that, you know, we'd like to add more events to a series. Let's say maybe a foiling event, or create some other things that can kind of go under the umbrella of a regatta series and grow up from there. But so, it's been hard to kind of take the HHS or HHSWRS. Some people are calling it SWRS, which is, doesn't, I don't know. So I still call it the nude, and it is what it is. But the beauty of it really is that at each location, it's primarily driven by the health of the local one design classes. And so at each venue, it has classes that are unique to it. I think the J105s and the J70s are probably the only two classes that are kind of endemic to all of them. And that's just because they're everywhere. But St. Petersburg in February is, to me, it's my personal favorite. Other than just being in St. Pete in February is fantastic. But the city, I don't know if you've been there, when we first started, it was a dump. And the transformation of that city in my lifetime has been amazing. You go down there now, it's a bit like, it's sort of a quasi Key West of Miami. The nightlife is insane. The sailing is really good. And the local sailing population is pretty avid, and they've got a good perf group in ORC. And so anyway, that's kind of our destination regatta of the series. And then we go.
A great yacht club there as well.
Oh, fantastic club. And they have the sailing center across the street, so it's easy to stage and launch boats. They've got all the capacities. And further north is Davis Island Yacht Club, which has a strong one design core to it. So it's easy for them to sail down and be part of it too. So that event keeps and has stayed strong, but we've, you know, one of the biggest changes, you know, back in the early days was all big boats. So we've been, you know, just being adaptive and adding dinghies and small classes wherever there's a demand. And I'm a big fan of bringing in a lot of these kind of forgotten one design classes, to bring them back to the table, make them, cause you know, you, as a class, you're never going to grow unless you're visible. Right. And so, in St. Pete last year, we had, you know, Contenders and Flying Dutchmen, to the Weta Trimarans, Foiling A-Cats. It just, the variety of classes is really cool. But I like kind of these older one design classes that have been forgotten, to bring them in and put them on the table with everybody else.
And how did you reach out to those guys and engage them in this? Because it's not necessarily a super well-organized class associations for some of these classes.
Yeah, you just got to call. And sometimes I think I've learned that a lot of them I've always said, well, we never thought we'd be invited. You know, we were not cool enough for it. And it's like, heck no, come on. If you can, I mean, the minimum fleet size is normally 5 to 10 boats, depending on the club. So, you know, even some of these smaller classes, like one this year we had the Wayfarer, which was just a cool little, you know, double-handed dinghy. Actually, there's quite a few of them in England.
And, yeah, it's big. It's big in Europe.
Yeah. And so, you know, they have a really strong kind of class structure, but they've always kind of communicated amongst themselves. But once you kind of bring them into the larger thing, they're just excited to be there and excited to be that actually people are paying attention to the class. And if that helps the class grow by one or two boats that, you know, maybe somebody was sailing in their sonar and they thought, I need something different. Oh, look at that Wayfarer. It looks cool. I've never seen one before. So it's a good way to get in front of more people, I guess. And, so you just got to call them and invite them and hope they can pull the fleet together. But there's a lot of one design classes here that still do their midwinter championships, you know, in Florida in kind of random unknown lakes or you never hear about them. And so trying to get them to come out of being alone and come and being part of the thing. But a lot of people also don't like multi-class regattas because they don't like to share a starting line where you got to wait for the three or four classes and you're sailing upwind through, you know, four classes coming downwind, it gets kind of silly. So it takes a bit of convincing to just say, you know, I understand that there's a lot of boats on this circle and you know, it's not going to be the perfect race course with open breeze, but just come and be part of the party and be part of the fun. And they're usually pretty responsive to it.
What's the biggest fleet you get overall regatta size?
That one also Saint Pete usually gets, I don't usually play the numbers game, but it's like 200 or so is usually a good target for Saint Pete. And Annapolis gets there, Chicago almost gets there, but you know, some of those numbers can be skewed in that, like for Saint Pete one year we had a big turnout, but it was a big A class cat year because it preceded the world. So I always say, yeah, it's a lot of boats, but my goal is always to get more boats with more bodies on them, right? So, and that's why I think embracing ORC and PERF and, you know, because that just brings more people to the party and, you know, just it creates much more of a scene. And as, you know, I'm a lazy sailor, so I'm just as guilty as the other ACAT guys where, you know, you come off the water, you're kind of whipped and you go back to your condo and you go to bed. And, you know, when you bring the big keel boats like Cows Week, it brings the fun, you know, you bring in more people and it just takes it to a whole nother level. So, but Annapolis, technically, so that's I'd say our purest one design event. We don't have much of a handicap racing scene there. And to me, Annapolis blows my mind every year. Like the J105 fleet just keeps getting bigger, the J80. So that's like it has such these strong core one design elements that we don't need to add the PERF classes. And so we again here like the big change. You know, another popular fleet there is called the Harbor 20, which was originally kind of a boat designed for the protected harbors of California. That was a WD Shock design. And that's become kind of the fleet boat for Annapolis because it's good for the older members. And they don't like to leave the harbor. Because the boats can be wet. But, you know, for about 10 years, we kept trying to get them to come and be part of it. And so this year we finally got them to come and race with us. So that was cool. But so Annapolis, is always a great one. Again, that's the beginning of their racing season because it's first week in May, so they've just kind of kicking off, and so that enthusiasm of the start of the season is always there, and you know they're good down there. So Chicago is kind of that's our sort of big boat event. You know, I think Chicago's always been full of big boats, and the tricky part of Chicago is that it used to all be Chicago Yacht Club. Is I don't know if you've ever been there, but it's an amazing giant club right on the lake, right in the heart of the city. They also have what's called Belmont Station, which is further up the lake. It's a kind of a floating barge club extension of the club, and so that's where all those J70s everybody launch from. So back in the day, you might see a Chicago Yacht Club back when there was all big boats. They'd raft up four or five deep off the bulkhead, and it was a giant scene. But now that we've got sort of classes spread at different locations up the lake, it's a little less of a scene, you know, but it's really fun. Yeah. So Knockwood, you know, so far this year, we've had great breeze at every event. And and Detroit, just to be, you know, we had them for a long time and they 10 years ago went off and said, oh, we can do this ourselves. And we brought them back this year. And that was a good turnout. I hadn't been to Detroit in a long time, but they, because their sailing season is so short, the enthusiasm is definitely through the roof, and they can race and party as hard as anybody I've ever met. And so it's quite a wild scene, but that one I think is poised to grow. I think Detroit is on a little bit more of a rebound, as the city is as well, as most Americans know. It was a pretty blighted city, and it is getting better. But so anyway, that's a new addition. And then Marblehead, i.e. Boston, that's essentially an extension of Boston, but Marblehead is just an amazing venue as well. You've got this beautiful deep harbor that's just jam-packed with boats on moorings. And three yacht clubs, we kind of rolled into what was Marblehead Race Week, which had been going on for 100 and something years. And so they rotate the responsibility amongst when the one's called Boston, Eastern, and Corinthian, these three clubs. So every year, a different club hosts it. And they do a junior race week before ours. And it's just cool. It's a wild scene. But, Marblehead is such, I'm sure those who live in Marblehead know what exactly I'm talking about. It's like this place, you Pleasantville, where you drive in and you just don't leave. And it's really hard to find housing for people. So it's not an event that you can bring in out of town classes and provide, and be able to get them in housing. Otherwise, you end up in hotels, 45 minutes away. It's terrible. So that one's always been kind of this very Marble-esque kind of scene. And the biggest fleet there is always the Rhodes 19, these classics, and one, a class called the Town Class, which is it's got a lap strake old style boat that, J.B. Braun, North Sales, he plays in this, and his wife has a boat. So this is kind of where the hotshots go play. But the reason is because you cannot get a mooring, or there's nowhere to put a boat in Marblehead. So if you want to buy a boat today, you'd have nowhere to put it. So these little town class things draw, 2 inches with the centerboard up. So they have they're called a trawl or something like that, where they can all kind of tie up in the shallowest part of the harbor.
And oh, so really?
If you want to get into a one design class, you kind of got to buy a townie, which is really weird. But the racing is great because there's a lot of old timers, and there's one fellow there who finds them in garages and barns and fixes them up and pushes them back out into the fleet, which is, it's always great. So anyway, you sum it up. Marblehead is our is classic Marblehead, and it's a great wrap to the season. And then at every regatta, we pick one overall winner. This is our partnership with Sunsail, who's been with us since the beginning. And Sunsail's part of this is that, forever, they were early in the campaign, they said, most racing sailors will use all their free time on regattas or train, whatever it is. They'll never go try a sailing vacation in the Caribbean. So let's give them one. Right. And so each year, at each event, we pick one winner, and they basically get a free, charter boat, whatever it is we want, whatever the one design fleet is, they have enough of in their, in Tortola.
Yeah.
These, Jeannot 47s or whatever it is. So it's a one design ish event. And the vast majority of people have never chartered a boat or been in the Caribbean, which is really cool. And then once you get down there, we basically for 7 days race them from island to island and host a party every night. And it is one of the best weeks of sailing I've ever done. It's just so much fun. I've done this BVI thing probably 15, 20 times, and it never gets old because it's new people every year. And it's just kind of cool to see the intimacy of these teams, play together and have fun at night. And by the end of the week, they're all, great friends. And it's a really wild team, but it's something we look forward to every year. It's sort of the perk of doing the regatta series.
I was going to say, you can never leave this job because you wouldn't want to leave that behind for sure. Yeah. For many other reasons too. But that relationship with Sunsail, how do they feel about what they get out of it? Because it's quite a big commitment to do that.
Yeah, I think on the market, I'm not a money and marketing side, but I think, they get good, you get good return on the visibility at every event. And we do the event actually the first week of last week of October into the first couple of days of November. But it follows the Interline Regatta, which is, I don't know if you ever heard of that. That's another wild one.
No,
but it's essentially it's the beginning of the season. So the boats are just coming out of the hurricane hole, and it's their flex month. So I think for the most part, the boats would be sitting there anyway. So this is a good way to, again, get exposure to people to do it. And so I think the one success story I always say is 1 year, Terry Hutchinson won the Annapolis Regatta in the J70 class sailing with his couple of his kids on the boat, or one or two, I can't remember, but he agreed to come and do the regatta, and he had a medical issue. I don't remember what it was, you know, like a couple of weeks before. So the doctor said, no way in hell can you race. So instead he worked through Sunsail and got a charter catamaran and brought, you know, all his kids and his wife down, and they just kind of tagged along with the regatta and everybody, and were just part of it. It was so cool to see, you know, people were just like, oh my God, Terry Hutchins is with us. But what he did was the following year, he actually spent all of his own money to go and charter a cat for their Thanksgiving break with the family. And he said that was the best sailing trip he'd done in his lifetime, you know? So, hey, you know, it convinced one of the best in the world to go try it. And I'm sure that, you know, that's the goal, is to then just spread the message there that, you know, even of those of us who race all the time, it's really fun to just wind it down and go have fun for a week too.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. It's something in this industry, the more you write about it, the less sailing you do. So it's you're absolutely right.
Well, I try that to that point. I do. That's it's kind of a hard, fast rule I've always had, is to make sure that, you know, I don't become a desk jockey or so. I do commit to doing either, you know, kind of commit to a program for a year, or at the bare minimum, getting out of the office and doing a regatta once a month, and sometimes twice a month. I don't show my bosses, but I try to be here as little as I can, but maintain the flow of everything I can. But we have to go and do it to keep the connections going and have fun and be knowledgeable about it. So yeah, that's like, if you play golf, if you write about golf, you better go play. Otherwise you're just going to hack your way through.
Well, one of the biggest attractions of this sport for me when I was growing up was sailing in the evenings, you know, after work. It kind of made the weeks so much shorter, because you'd sail at the weekends and then you'd maybe do, at our club, we did Wednesday nights, and then there was a kind of unofficial Friday night thing. So it broke the week up really smoothly. I just imagine in Newport, you could pick and choose what you want to go and do, couldn't you? Is this sailing every night of the week?
Yeah, there was a moment there before I had kids that I was literally sailing Monday through Thursday, and then the regattas here would start Friday. So I'd do 7 days straight. Those were the glory years for sure. And then, you know, when you have kids, I have to dial it back. And so now I just basically racing two nights a week, either do the Wednesday night Shield stuff or Perf. And then my longstanding gig has always been with the J24 fleet here, which I've sailed the same guy since I was in high school. So I do the math, almost like 40 years. And for us, yeah, it's like Thursday night, it's just with the boys, and we have females too now, but it was just our Thursday night gathering. It's just been, it's locked on the calendar. Nothing changes. And even if they blow off racing, we'll just still go do a lap around the harbor with the beers and just sort of share it. But yeah, so it's myself and this guy Herb McCormick, who's hands down one of the best marine writers on the planet. And he's always sort of been a mentor of mine, because he's the one who gave me the job back in the New York Times days. And so he still lives here in Newport, and he's one of my regular stringers. And he grew up with the guy, this guy Ian, who owns the boat, and they owned it together for a long time. And so these are, again, two high school buddies still sailing together collectively they've got to be sailing together 60 years or so. I don't know.
Fantastic. Yeah. Absolutely fantastic. You've mentioned it now, how you got the job. You went off to get your journalism degree. Was the plan to just come back and do this, or was the plan to journalism in some other form?
Yeah, not at all. Again, I was sort of, actually, my brain, I was going to California, had a girlfriend out there at the time, and I had the truck ready to go cross country and start my life in California. And this was just supposed to be a summer gig. It was fun. And it actually, the internship, like most do end, and so I spent about 3 or 4 months delivering boats from here down through the Caribbean, and that was cool as a 21-year-old, just getting in a lot of ocean miles and seeing the world that way. And then when I came back, I actually worked for, at the time they had a magazine called Sailing Business, which was a trade publication, and did a short stint there until one of the sailing editors left, and then slid right over. And so worked my way up, managing editor for a while. And then John Burnham, who was the previous editor at some point, he, you know, called me at his office and said, he was shifted over to Cruising World, said, it's all yours now, go for it. And so, okay, sure. Yeah, yeah.
So how long ago was that?
So that would have been 96, I believe, if I do it right. I'd have to go back. I'm pretty sure 96. It's been too long, but yeah. So it's kind of trippy for somebody to say, all right, well, you know, this is yours now, because as you know, we're just curating this thing every month. And this is back when we had 12 and how do I do this? Right. And so we have these giant planning boards and I still do it is like, just start with a blank slate literally and say, all right, well, we've got to do at least look on from the US perspective, like we got to make sure we get some West Coast coverage because there's such great stuff happening there, and East Coast, Great Lakes, the South, try to cover the geographic spread of this country to make sure that we're sort of giving a good picture of everything. And then, all right, well then add another filter, big boat, small boat, you know, high performance dinghy, grassroots. Let's mix that in, people, events, regattas, trends, America's Cup, Olympics. And then you're like, how do we fit all this into a calendar is always an amazing, you know, puzzle to try to get together. But to me, that's always been the fascinating thing is like, no, you know, as you and I both know, no single day is ever the same. Every time you open up your email, you're like, oh, that's a cool story. And how do we go on that one? So it's never been boring. And that's kind of what keeps me coming back every day is it's got a bit of a 9-to-5-ish type of thing that's been good for the family. And within that 9-to-5 frame, I can, you know, go off and do my own regattas or I can, you know, put you on a story or go do it myself. If I say that's something I've always wanted to do, I can just go do it. And you know, luckily I got, you know, my expenses paid for and come back and write the story. And I've tried to add in, you know, the one thing I've always been true to is to not pretend to be a photographer because I feel like that's just taking their lunch. You know,
absolutely.
That's what we do. We need them to do it and they need to do it well and I need to pay them. And so I've stayed away from doing photography, but I think as a natural thing is nowadays when we have GoPros, we can't not get into the video game as well. So I do quite a bit of video projects. I enjoy those because it's the same thing. It's just video visual storytelling in a different way. And you know, I approach it the same way I would have written piece of trying to build a narrative arc. And, you know, so, yeah.
Now, I saw one of the Sailing World pieces, which I suspect was probably created by you, which was a practice race on a J70. And I can't remember the name of the sailors.
I know exactly what you're talking about. And ironically enough, yeah, that's still today our most viewed video piece we've ever done.
I thought it was absolute genius because it was for me, it just said, you know, a properly run boat, this is the conversation that should be going on board the boat. And, you know, just the level of attention and focus and, you know, quiet voices and, you know, the crew weight. I just thought it was really well done. I watched that a couple of times and it.
Oh, good. Yeah. So you must be helping the number counts a little bit. Yeah. That was, so the first, this is what we did. It was at our St. Pete regatta where I had this idea again, like it can only be really done on a practice race really, you know, to do it right. And so luckily the 70s take their practice racing very seriously down there. And so, the first thing we did was with Steph Roble and Willem van Wey, who is he's amazing. But I just go back to the second one that we and that was just thrown together. And I'll give away my secrets in that you use the same thing you're wearing a DJI wireless or in the day it was these Rode wireless mics where I could put one on the two people who are doing the talking the most, right? And this is where I called it a listen and learn because sometimes you just need. By just listening and watching what they do, that's how we kind of absorb, right? We, on every boat you and I get on, there's a pro. We kind of come back and maybe use some of their lingo or some of the things that we picked up from them. So it's just all about this kind of absorbing the knowledge. And so the nice thing about this practice race is only up and downwind. So you can kind of really capture both legs. You don't need all four because it's basically just be repeating itself. So just capture the start, the upwind leg, and the end. But I have this giant extendable carbon pole I strapped the GoPro on it, but I didn't know what to use. So I actually found a 49er tiller extension at St. Pete Yacht Club and buried back in the wood and just basically, I think, duct taped the camera to it. And so that to me is always, we were in a rib. You got to be, you know, basically an extension of the boat hooked into it. The onboard camera perspective doesn't work because it's so one dimensional and you need to be able to sort of, I think because we've been around long enough, I could sort of tell the driver, well, let's pull back and kind of see what the overall fleet look is when he's starting. And I can't hear what he's saying, but I know what he's, you know, I know he's kind of talking through different scenarios and say, okay, well, now we're getting back at the top of the, you know, the upwind cone. Let's get in a little closer to the mark rounding. And anyway, so the fixed camera perspective, I don't think works, but the year after we did one with Andy Horton and Travis Odenbach, it's also there. And I think that actually came out even better because Travis is, he's really good, but he was on a rail. He's a, you know, former quantum guy, but Andy Horton is magical in this one. I definitely recommend you watch because he's one of these, and the owner did not say a single word the entire race. It's just Andy just talking about heel angle and this and that, talking through scenarios. And so to me, I could go back and watch that every day because you just sort of, I learn something every time I do watch it. So, but anyway, so that same approach, wireless mics and a GoPro and following, and that to me is really good. And so at a regatta series, to the point that even we have a full-time, or he's a videographer, that's what he does for profession. And he keeps trying to complicate it, right? He's like, well, let's do a drone and this and that. And to me, it's like, no, now you're just overcomplicating it. Like there's this beauty of the simplicity of just being close to them and following them and just capturing the audio. We don't need all this extra stuff.
I 100% agree. 100% agree. That would kind of become distracting, I think, for me watching. So
that's the beauty of, I think, the little Listen Learn projects is that it's like, you know, you start in the 5-minute sequence, follow them through. Most practice races are 15, 20 minutes. And it's literally just cut the ending, cut the beginning, put it into Adobe Rush, which is a, you know, amateur movie making platform, no different than iMovie, and put some logos or whatever, and just straight to the web. I think that first one probably, you know, was done an hour later. So on the production side of it, yeah, it's not fancy, but it's not bad. It's just not meant to be. It's just, you're supposed to just learn something from it, and, you know, don't worry about the razzle dazzle. So, but yeah, so that stuff's been fun. And on the video side, a fun project I did, I went down and did a written story for a fleet of boats called, these Dyer Dows. It was a feature. These are these little 9-foot dinghies that they race frostbite style in Riverside, Connecticut, which is Greenwich, which is just outside New York City. But so they have 95 of these things on the dock. And to me, that is insane, right? And these things were all designed in the 1960s. They're silly little, you know, boats that sink very easily. But this group is so hardcore with these boats. And they've really fleet modernized it with proper, they'd redesigned the rudders and just made the boat more modern, fixed it, right? And so as part of it, I do a lot of video interviews just because it's a good way to capture the audio and I can pull quotes from that for the story. But I ended up putting the camera on the guy who's the fleet leader. This guy, John Singson, is really good. He's a, you know, really dynamic dinghy sailor, and kind of mic'd him up for one race. And in building this movie, I called it a movie because it ended up coming out about 30 minutes, which people said, oh, it's way too long for YouTube. And I was like, well, screw it. You know, I want to do a sort of a feature length sailing movie. And so between the normal interviews about this class and its growth, and I went out with the old timer that was the top guy for 20 years and kind of mic'd him up and did the similar thing, like the Listen Learn, and had him describe how he sails the boat through puffs and yada yada. And so between piecing that and then this onboard clip from John, which, and in making this kidding, I kept trying to chop it to make it shorter, but the more I chopped it, the more I hated it. So I said, you know, why don't we just go on board with this guy and just, you can listen because he talks to himself the way he breathes. Sometimes he'll just yell at himself, but you could see, you know, he does like 40 tacks on the beat just because you could tell he's just on it every shift in this weird current. And to me, it was like, wow, that's so cool to be in with the best guy. And anyway, so it came to be this 30-minute movie that I did a showing at the club last fall and had some beers. And so anyway, to me, it's like this old Warren Miller style movie making and sailing that I don't think we do that well, like as a sport, right? Because it's all just clips and it got me thinking recently about, you know, like the Mirrorball, the photo awards that they do in the videos, and it, like, why don't we do really push for more, not feature length, but good proper story movie making for sailing? Because, you know, we're still talking about wind, right? And what's you know, so in our world, it's some of the stuff that came out of the ocean race, it's great, you know, but nobody's ever really done I think, a proper good movie.
No, I agree. And, you know, on YouTube now, the stuff I watch, they're telling me that the longer form videos are now the way to go if you want to, you know, for the YouTube algorithm and all that sort of stuff. So maybe we'll see it, you know, maybe we'll see it in other sports. And I think it's already there in other sports, because I do see stuff that's half an hour long about, you know, a basketball player or a golf player or something like that. So
and I wonder aloud as we chat that, you know, some of the stuff that, I mean, God bless them, it's so well produced with the CLGP and the series that they're doing and even the cup stuff, but there's also this tint of, like, it's kind of like the Drive to Survive, where you just don't know if it's really real or how much of this is kind of scripted, or, you know. So I think you take it down a level to, like, real people making movies about their classes or their regattas and kind of their experiences, with just sort of more authentic grassroots movie making would be kind of cool for sailing, I think.
Absolutely. No, I can 100% agree. Now that you've mentioned SailGP, I wanted to just, I mean, we're coming towards the end of our time a little bit. I wanted just to ask you about the professional scene. Now you're a pretty good place to observe and comment a little bit on it. We've got SailGP, we've got America's Cup, we've got the Ocean Race, which is in a bit of a state of flux. We've got the Vendée, which is in its ascendancy, 42 boats this time, or I think so. How do you see it? What's your kind of general take on it all?
Ooh, I might make some people angry, but I keep trying to become a fan of CLGP, but I don't know. It's just not doing it for me, right? And I think probably because they don't. And I say they. I think the pro sailors, like, and at one point, I think I did do this experiment where we could do it today and go look at all the top skippers of the CLGP. This is back with Bill and everybody else. Of, like, their social media presence is so dismal compared to other traditional professional league athletes that they don't do a good job of, and it's work, right? And some of they could step up their game in terms of being real authentic and being known, right? And so you just look at their own numbers and just look at their social profiles. They don't do a lot, and so I think they're not helping themselves. And then I think sometimes the problem with SailGP is there's just so much dead space between events, and there's no emotional human connection to these guys and women. But then all of a sudden, you know, the event happens, and then your social feed is just, it's like on fire. And then it's sort of like, okay, well, too much. And then you don't know how to consume it because it's coming from every team. It's coming from the league. And but I've enjoyed what I like to do is because normally the racing's always on weekends, so I'm always sailing myself. So I've never been able to actually sit and watch a real, you know, live broadcast unless it's some, you know, some off hours or something. And I actually enjoy watching it the next day and not reading the news for spoilers, but I like the fact that I can speed through all of the, you know, kind of fluff on either side of the racing, because I don't need to know. I know that's good for a general audience, but I don't need to know. I will watch any bits or story color pieces about the sailors because I want to get to know them a little better. But for the most part, I just kind of go to the racing and watch. And it is kind of cool that, you know, I can sit and consume an entire day of CLGP in about 35 minutes and kind of enjoy it. But I think there's a, particularly the US team, I mean, as much as they say they do inspire, I just get a sense, I don't think they've really ever connected with the American audience, maybe the non-sailing audience, but the sailing audience, I don't think is ever really bought into it. And I could be wrong, but part of that was Jimmy. I don't know, but our new guys, you know, Mike and Taylor, were beating up on them pretty hard because I do think they came in with a lot of bluster, and they were not prepared for the shellacking that they're getting. And they knew it was coming. And so I'm a realist. It's better to come in humble and say, yeah, we're going to suck for a while, but believe in us. But, you know, to come in and be like, hey, we're going to be the disruptor, that was a bad approach. But that's a bit of Buckley. It's the way he portrays himself and the whole scene, and he's kind of got this chip on his shoulder, and, you know, everybody hates us now, so we just kind of feeding this thing, and I'm like, oh god, you know, just do your thing, be humble, go out and race, and, you know, have fun with it. And so those guys, I've always surprised, you know, again, it kind of goes to that they had this opportunity where, you know, they, whatever, the wing trimmer, Victor Diaz de Leon, you know, gone, and they bring in Jeremy Wilmot. But I will challenge them. You go back, I have not seen a single anything about Jeremy in terms of like, oh, you got a new guy on the team, like what's about, but they've just kept him silent. And so there's these missed opportunities where they we just don't know who's on the boat. And it's, I don't know, they're a long way to go, but the league keeps growing. Now they're, you know, adding more boats. Hopefully this Brazil team, I just so hope it will be Martin Grail. You know, I don't know why they need
absolutely
to be changed, but it's like, here's the chance to put who will whip most of these guys any day. And if it's not, I'm going to be so mad. But anyway, between
such a missed opportunity if that's not the case.
So I'm kind of hopeful that that will help. And I'm not a big, you know, I think it's been one of the greatest things in the sport that I see it here and I see it all our events. Hands down, there's more women in the sport, and that has been great. The party's more fun. It's just it's just better for all the reasons. And the women are beating us on every high level, right? You know, on the ocean relation level and on the popularity level and social level, everything. They're just better at it than the guys. Is what it is. The guys are, you know, we're all too cool, and you know, like the women are just more honest and relatable, and so that's good for the sport.
Yeah, for sure. Just skim me through the America's Cup. I know we had a conversation a couple of weeks ago about it being kind of a little underrepresented in the US. People haven't really latched on to this Barcelona Cup.
Yeah, I think, and again, I probably will piss off Terry Hutchinson again, but you know, after the last cup, we had a conversation. I said the same thing. I don't, the quote unquote American audience did not fall in love with American Magic, right? Until they capsized, and then everyone felt bad for them. And you know, all of a sudden, you know, they had a fan base, but it was too late, right? And so from the get go of their campaign, even the second time around, they keep saying, oh, this is going to be the start of American sailing excellence. We're going to resonate. We're going to connect with the American sailing audience and the yacht clubs. And that hasn't happened. You know, we try to do at all the Regatta series, we do a speaker series nights. We've tried early on before they got busy in Barcelona, we try to bring him in and just be visible in front of crowds at yacht clubs. And, you know, they'll do a couple dog and pony shows here and there, but the outreach, I personally don't think got outside of Pensacola, you know,
right.
It's fine. They got their fans there and they've got their fans at the New York Yacht Club, but you know, and maybe anybody who's had some touch point with them can be inspired. But I think as a whole, and this may be Terry just, he's right in that the goal is to win the cup, not to, you know, build the biggest fan base. You know, once you win the cup, then you can build a fan base. So maybe he's right. And at the end, and hopefully they'll go win it and bring it back here, and then start the other job of getting Americans excited about the cup. But I think it's anytime you probably see it, anytime we post anything about the cup or this or that, people go, oh, bring back the 12 meters or yawn. So there's just this continued underlying tone of people just disconnected with it. And those are all, those are going to be the cranky people anyway, that are not going to like any progress. So nothing we can do about that. So I think, I personally love the technology. I've been a believer that, you know, just like the J-class era, the boats have to be stunning and just second to none, right? Otherwise, it's just another sailing regatta. We have the 52. We have great Grand Prix racing, but the America's Cup has to be something that is completely out of this world and stratospheric. So I think they're you know, it's staying true to that. And you've seen it closer than anybody that I know. And I'm hopeful that Barcelona will be kind of the European sailing sporting spectacle that it can be.
As long as
they welcome the tourists back in, which I imagine right now is giving AC events a bit of heartburn.
Yeah. That's a complex scenario that's happening all over Europe. I don't think going to Barcelona or Barcelona, you know, pitching for the cup was about attracting more tourists, because they've got more than they know what to do with anyway.
Yeah.
I think it was more about positioning the city as somewhere that can host these, you know, huge kind of high profile events. Maybe huge is the wrong word for the cup, but so I think from that point of view, it'll do well for them.
Yeah, I think once you bring in, I think the return of Louis Vuitton, right, and then all the showmanship that Red Bull brings, and I'm sure it's Luna Rossa will bring their class into it. So I think it has all the pieces to be a really top end, beautiful sporting event. And so I look forward to sort of taking part in some of it. That's the problem for us. It's such a giant time commitment. So I've got to figure out which touch points to get there. Obviously, start for the Challenger Series and the semifinals, and and then for the Cup itself. Yeah. But I want to stick around for the youth and women's America's Cup. I think that'd be fascinating to watch. And I think we all of us need to do a good job of, this is our chance to take this next generation and get them better known. It's on us as well. It's not just the Cup to do it. So I'd like to see some of that, and whatever else happens on the side, I think it'd be cool.
And I think some of those youngsters are going to be the helmsman of the next Cup. I mean, certainly the Italian Marco Gradoni, his future's very bright, and I wouldn't be surprised to see him on the wheel this time around. Even I think there's some debating going on within the team who's best. Big calls for a 19-year-old on the wheel.
Yeah, I'd argue that about 99.9% of Americans have never heard of Marco. That's cool to me that he can emerge. And what is he, 19?
He was 19 when I interviewed him last year, so he's probably in it. He's probably 20, maybe 21.
That's cool. Yeah, he's probably got the brain wired for it. And
three-time Optimist World Champion, and he's part of the foiling generation. So these boats were purpose built for him. It's incredible. You mentioned the Cup having to have this, the fastest boats, the highest technology. I feel like the Volvo was always about that as well. The Volvo 70s were always the Volvo always had these super fast, the fastest boats on the planet for ocean racing. I think it took a bit of a dip with the 65s because they definitely weren't that. They were fast and they were durable for sure. And it got us away from this, so many breakages and boats not arriving in stopovers. But I think it lost something there. I'm not certain, but I feel like for next time around, they're just going to go with the Imoca 60s, which kind of are back to that state-of-the-art
cutting edge
stuff.
Yeah.
Could you imagine them going to two people?
No, and it's funny because I had a great conversation with Charlie Enright not long ago about this. And I think one of the most enjoyable parts of watching the race was the leg down through Gibraltar and down, where they had the 65s and the Mochas going. And it was such a cool contrast to see, the sort of the video, what came off the boats of on the Mochas, it's all game playing, right? Inside the bubble and really trying to figure out how to play. But then meanwhile, back at 65s, it was just misery, right? And that was that kind of I love seeing, but that's what it should be, is this sort of, it's easy for us to say from the armchair, but the visuals were so much more compelling off the 65s of just the wetness and the waves and still that old, vision of getting pummeled by the fire hose. And the dichotomy of the experiences in that one leg was fascinating. And so I don't know, I think there's maybe the double-handed would certainly kill it. Cause I think you do need the characters, right? And that's Rosalind Cooper, right, and Boris, they caught the imagination of the world better than anybody, I think, in that race. And to be fair to Charlie as well, I think he came out of his shell much more differently this time around, and actually enjoyed watching his kind of personal journey through the whole thing. And so the people, right, otherwise they're just sailboats. And so as we've learned from the Cole Brouwer, experiment or whatever experience that we've had, that here's somebody who finishes second in a race that nobody knew about or nobody cared about, but they cared about her and the experience and what the message is or whatever this experience she delivered from the boat. So putting two people on a boat, you have the risk of, one is always off watch and it's just gonna feel like a Vendée kind of video show. I don't anyway, but I looked, there's got to be some happy medium where it's some fast sailing with some outside exposure and some, you know, inside the boat technical sailing. But anyway,
yeah,
it was cool to see the fleet coming here. Obviously, you know, we're blessed with having Newport as a stopover, and each time, whether it was in the Ocean Race or this recent one, you know, I can speak for even my family and the kids, or the interaction with the school kids here was amazing. And just seeing kids pour through the gates and getting autographs from these people that they're following, that's so important, right? So once you go away from having people on the boat, then who are these kids going to aspire to be? You know, there needs to be more characters. And so, yeah. Anyway, I guess that's my two cents on that is, get back to crews of six, you know, maybe three and three.
I'm with you. I'd go. Yeah. I'm absolutely with you. Let's just round it off with the Vendée. Obviously we're in a Vendée year. It's going to be a massive fleet that sets out. And, it seems to me that the level at the top of the fleet is, you know, arguably the best it's ever been. There's usually this little kind of pyramid at the top that people who have a chance of winning it, but there's a lot of good sailors and good boats this time around.
Yeah, I was gutted to not be in New York because we had our events going out in Chicago and Detroit at the same time, and so to me it was cool to see. And yeah, I guess I'm a huge fan of Charlie Dunlin, and like there's, you know, and then you could, there's so many good people there, but I think again it goes to the characters, and I guess I'm hitting on the same drum. I'm always fascinated to see the women rising through this to the top of this class, and these young 20 somethings that showed up in New York just at the start of their career. It's just cool to see. I did a story. God, I can't remember her name now. She did the mini transat on a foiling mini transat. But anyway, you're like, man, she's just so smart, like technically smart, and just really savvy on the fundraising. And you're like, man, they're doing amazing things. So, and in that vein, you know, I guess it'd be my other female stories that on the 52s. And again, I can't remember her name. The navigator that did the med series with Quantum. I'd never heard of her before. And I was like, so you Google who she is. And she's worked at the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory for whatever, 10 years. Like, okay, well, there's somebody wicked smart and cool to see. Yeah. So anyway, it's great, great trend in the sport.
I guess the good thing for all of us, I think the message from this little chat we've had is the sport's in good shape. I mean, in terms of stories to write about, there's things to write about, stories, there's so much out there right now.
Yeah, and it's funny. I wrote an editorial about 2 issues ago, and with the headline like "Sailing is cool right now," and it was sort of on the heels of again like 11th Hour finally winning, and Kirsten Neubauer, you know, winning the Globe race, and it just sort of like, and man, there was a certain website I'm not going to name, but in their forums, I just got hammered. You know, like he doesn't always, the sport is dying, and but. I don't buy the numbers game. And so yeah, maybe the sport is shrinking, but at the end of the day, it's not really about the numbers, and it's about the vitality and I think it's just the sport's changing. Right. You know, and what I say is cool is that whether it's America's Cup, CLGP, Vendée, all these things we've been talking about, you know, it is getting other people to pay attention to sailing, but we see here, it's like wing foiling is still sailing. Kiting, the Melges 15 explosion of double-handed dinghy sailing here. I look at our ORC, IRC fleets and the big boat racing, Wednesday night racing. I don't know. I think there's a lot of cool stuff happening. And again, the women's emergence and youth focus on that. And man, you go to any of these high level youth events and the level of sailing is insane. And so so maybe it's shrinking, but It's cool. There's a lot happening, and so it's a lot to be excited about. I'm more of a positive guy, I guess, at the end of the day.
I'm 100% with you, and I think that's a great message to to end this podcast. I'll be back again with another podcast pretty soon. But Dave, for now, thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to chat. I think the listeners will really enjoy it.
Oh, thanks. It was great to catch up and keep doing what you're doing with the podcast. It's good that you're doing it because somebody said, "Hey, Sailing Rules should do a podcast." I was like, there's no way I can add another thing to my list. So no, you do it. You do it great. And yeah, this is it's funny because it took me a long time to sort of warm up to podcasts and, you know, they were popular once, went away and died. And a good friend of mine, Stu Stroyla, who's the director of comms at New York Yacht Club, he kind of got me back into it again. I bike to work basically. So I've got a 30-minute ride of listening that it used to be all music, but I'm trying to expand my skill sets to not just listen to music, but listen to people talk while I ride. So anyway, yeah, it's cool. It's good to see the podcast. I think that is for us, you know, it's, as I said before, it's getting harder and harder to get the pros to write because it takes work. But at least this is a good platform to get them on the phone and try to get them to get some good authentic storytelling out of them. And
yeah, so, they do seem happy to chat like this for an hour. And I think we're lucky in our sport. We have good access to our athletes. You know, we don't know we're born from that. I've got friends who write about football and it's a completely different situation. So,
absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Media training kills them all.
Yeah. So. Yeah. That's right. So we don't want our guys to get any more media trained than they already are. And that's a real problem, actually, I think. Anyway, yeah. I don't want to get onto another subject. As I say, thanks so much for taking the time. And we'll be back soon with.
All right. Yeah. Well, hopefully, see you in Barcelona.
See you then.
Okay.